This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is iFanboy Pick of the Week, number 852, brought to you by iFanboy listeners, hearers, just like you.
There I was, a fair affair, all black and brown and covered in hair. Three boys are going to dance in there. They danced and spun right to the fair. How sweet she was and pure and fair. The man with honey up in her hair.
Hey, welcome to iFanboy Pick of the Week, episode 852. I am Josh Flanagan. I'm here with my co-host and life partner, Connor Kilpatrick.
It was a late night last night.
Oh, man. It's sexy time, Connor?
I don't know. I don't know what it is.
It would be sexy time if I wasn't totally exhausted and hungover.
I have no energy for any of this.
Joining us today in the third chair is Dr. Ryan Haupt.
Hello, everyone. I'm happy to be here celebrating 1 week of being bear-free. No bears for an entire week.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Dr. Ryan Haupt has a young child at home. He was up most of the night. Connor had himself a little celebration last night. Connor is nearly 45 years old, so everyone's doing great. I still don't have a job. We are iFanboy, and every week one of us picks the book they like the best from their stack of comics, and we call that the pick of the week. We talk about that book. We talk about other books from the week. We talk about the patron pick. We answer some listener mail if we have time. And from what I understand, we really want to have time for it this week, so we're going to go for that. You might be thinking, why don't they talk endlessly about this book or something that's only vaguely related to that book? And that's what we're going to shoot for. Your spoiler warning is that there are spoilers. You know how that works. You're an intelligent individual listening to this, so you're on your own there. Ryan, you had the pick.
I did, and I decided that the pick of the week was Deceased, War of the Undead Gods, number 3 of 8. I added that to the script just because I feel like we always wonder how long the miniseries is going to go. And I have been, like all of y'all, I've been enjoying the Deceased books. They're better than they've had any right to be. And I think we all were excited about this miniseries returning, but I think the first two issues were really sort of setting up the stakes and putting the heroes in the worst situation possible. And I felt like this issue was where the tide turned slightly towards, okay, now I see how our heroes might have a chance. And I thought that was good. I think it was needed. I think it was, otherwise this book would just be too bleak, even though this was a very bleak book. And I think in a lot of ways, there were a couple of Halloween books or Halloween adjacent books that came out this week, but I actually think this one captured the spirit of spooky season better than most. I mean, it is some sense a zombie book. I should also say that this was a story by Tom Taylor, art by Trevor Harrison, and colors by Rain Barreto, letters by Seda Timofonte. And it starts off with a flashback of what happened to Adam Strange, and we've been living in the midst of the Adam Strange-assance.
That was a good sequence.
It was a great sequence. I loved, instead of having a big flashy Zeta Beam moment in this version of Adam Strange, he just kind of fades out of Ran and back to Earth, and him doing that, hugging his daughter. As Josh mentioned, a parent of a young child, if there was something really bad happening, I would feel not great if I was against my will teleported away from my family. And then his confrontation with Wonder Woman. I know, right? And then I thought his confrontation with Wonder Woman after that was really good. And everything that followed. I mean, this even had a Lobo sequence that didn't suck.
We're really into the depths of how is this now spreading throughout the universe. So see it. We see this anti-life zombie equation hitting Ron. We see it hitting Thanagar. We see it going, you know, hey, it's all the planets from Cosmic Odyssey. And we see it sort of going around. I didn't hate the Lobo sequence, although I genuinely tend to hate Lobo, but it wasn't terrible.
It was interesting because I was thinking about when it happened. Obviously, he refers to himself as the main man, which makes my face twitch. But if he's the guy who can't be affected and can sort of beat the thing, like that's really interesting because you've taken this character who's annoying and it totally makes sense. And so it's going to annoy everybody, you know, at least, I mean, in the universe. I mean, I just love the idea that, not unlike something we've experienced in our world, just when you think you've got it sorted out, you zoom back and you're like, oh yeah, by the way, this is the rest of the universe. Oh shit. Mm-hmm. You know, and as soon as the Zeta Beam came into it, I thought, oh my God, that's terrible.
I actually think the scene that did it for me, and when I read this book pretty early in my stack, and the scene that did it for me where I was like, okay, that's the scene that every other book has to beat this week, is when Ares shows up and is literally complaining about, like, oh God, like, this is literally the problem of the new gods. I am an old god, and I'm annoyed by the young gods coming in and messing up the universe. And like one of his solutions is like, okay, I'm going to take whatever's left of the Justice League into the Hall of the Gods, and we can arm up. And he gives Ollie Apollo's bow, and he picks it up and says, it feels a little off. And he's like, you're saying the golden bow of Apollo feels a little off? Like, it was made perfect for the god Apollo. And like, and Ollie's like, yeah, still feels a little off. And goes, Ares, fine, you can modify it. And I was like, that was awesome. That was a great moment.
Yeah.
At some point, he's like, Darkseid, he's a fucking child. Like,
I know. That's great. That's a perspective that we don't often get to see in DC, where, you know, Darkseid is, and Darkseid is considered this unflappable pillar of a part of the universe, and to have like an older god come in and just kind of grimace and be annoyed with him, I thought worked.
And so is this Erebos character, is that who's behind all this? That was the only thing.
That seemed to be the reveal, but I don't.
Erebos. I don't know. Anyway, it was interesting. It was good.
Reading this after we talked about Cosmic Odyssey, which is the book spoiler you can listen to back in the feed from this, is that you get the idea that the anti-life equation is something that Darkseid toyed with, which was what was happening in that book, you know, 34 years ago. And that, like, he's not really the thing. So in that, the anti-life is a cosmic, is it being? Is that correct? You know, like, there's another big thing back there. And I don't know if Erebos was something that was born out of that or something we've never heard of. Although Tom Taylor in these books doesn't tend to make things up. He takes them from existing things.
I think what we did talk on that show is that the anti-life equation is very malleable. You know, it can be sort of whatever you need it to be. And so here, I mean, we don't really know much about this character, but it does give them something that they can actually defeat, as opposed to like a germ, which, you know, you can't punch. So it gives it more of a possible endgame.
I like the idea of a zombie type I don't know, pathogens, maybe not the right word, but like a zombie type infection that spreads through data, like an equation. There was a pretty good movie that came out a couple of years back called The Signal. It was sort of that same thing where like everybody's TV or phone or radio started broadcasting like this static image that if you saw it drove you insane. And I was like, and you know, this is sort of like that. And I think I like that,
like,
kind of
like
story.
Real Housewives.
Well, only, I mean,
come
some
on.
Some of them.
I'm not giving you that. You didn't earn that.
I did. That's how that makes me feel. Like, I start clawing at my own hair. Why is anyone watching this? Here's what I'm also curious about. Have any of these Justice League folks, have they tried ivermectin? What, that one? Can I have that one?
Eh, I think Justice League's more of a hydroxychloroquine crab.
I
couldn't say that.
I mean, I agree with you, Ryan, that the first two issues, it was like, okay, let's get going here. This is the final act of a story that's been really great and really suspenseful and exciting. And the first two felt kind of like they were just sort of, I don't want to say treading water, but they were sort of, there wasn't a lot going on when you only had eight more issues to go. But now I think we're finally moving.
I think they lulled us into that false sense of security because it really came back like, hey, we're fixing things, you know? And right. And which doesn't make any sense for a story. There's no narrative drama there or anything. But also, I want that to happen. So I don't know that I was like, okay, I'll just watch them clean things up. I'm happy with that. You know, like to fix a thing. And obviously, they're going to just rip a rug out from under you. And it's good. But, you know.
Trevor Harrison continues to be also as important on this book as Tom Taylor. I think his work is terrific. He does all the characters in the DC universe in this book. And they're all terrific.
And it's really interesting because I don't think that his style necessarily lends itself to, you know, if it's like the regular Justice League book, it would feel too dark or too rough or something like that. Yeah. And I don't mean to say that in a sense like I feel like he's a niche artist, because I think that the fundamentals are super strong. I love the way his figures look. You know, I love the way Adam Strange looks in this. But it's just left of center enough that it really, it gives this story both things, where it feels like something other than the quote-unquote reality that we're used to. But at the same time, all those fundamentals are there. You know, there's all of the elements of a mainstream superhero comic book artist are at play, but it's just got enough to it that lets you know that there's something extra, there's something different. You know, it's not necessarily darker, but in this context, it is.
Yeah. It's a little rougher around the edges. Everyone is a little bit. I like how sort of tall and lean everybody is. You know, no one's like incredibly bulky. You know, yeah. Superman isn't like, coming out of his suit like that Action Comics artist. Like, it's everyone's sort of just
you tend to like that more.
Yeah, I like that.
I mean, I saw a tweet this week that was something along the lines of like, Superman shouldn't be super muscly because if he was evolved as Kryptonian to be that strong, nothing on Earth would give his muscles enough of a workout that he would be bulky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a visual language issue. Now, there are times where it works. I mean, I think it depends on the story and the artist or whatever. I mean, I'm not going to complain about Ed McGuinness's Superman. Or yeah, when I think of one of my favorite Supermans ever is Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns Superman. I love how big he is in that, because in there it's a symbol of a different thing. You know what I mean? Like he represents different things given the story, and I think that interpretation. Same with Batman. Same with Batman. But yeah, it works here.
There was a lot of books this week. It was, you know, it feels like DC puts out all of their good books in the same week.
And it's so the week that Ryan's here.
Yeah, so you get all of their high-end books. So we're not even going to get to all of them just because there were so many of them. But we did need to talk about the final issue of Batman the Knight. This is number
10. this was a contender for Pick of the Week. I think my takeaway from the conclusion of this story, which has been written by Chip Zdarsky and wonderfully drawn by Carmine DiGiomenico.
DiGiandomenico.
DiGiandomenico, thank you. I would be perfectly content,
as it says here in the script.
Yeah,
that was Gian Bomenico.
That's the typo.
And then of course colors by Ivan Palsentia.
Yes,
which is nice. I said he was up all night.
And letters by Paprissa.
Who sent you? My pal sent you.
I would be perfectly content if this was the canonical origin story of Bruce Wayne moving forward.
There have been several of these, like, what did you do after? And this is just another one. I mean, it's a good one. There's nothing wrong with it. I'd be fine with it.
I like it existing as legend, though. Like, this is one of the legends. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But you're absolutely right. It makes total sense. It's funny because if you were to tell me right now, hey, name me some Chip Zdarsky stories that are great, I'd go, oh man, you got Stillwater and you got Public Domain and over there he's got Daredevil. And I don't know that I would list this, but in any other sort of current comic book writer, this would be the best thing they did.
Well,
and
he's
on such a roll.
You picked this twice for Pick of the Week, Josh?
No, I know that. That's what I'm saying. Like, he's firing on all. Also, that doesn't even count it because he's reaching out in all different directions. I kind of forget about it. I have picked it. I think it's great. Every time it comes in, I'm happy. I loved this ending, but it's still a little under the radar from, I don't kind of think of it until it's in front of me, whatever reason.
I really loved how nervous Bruce was going home because of Alfred, not because of anything else, like not because he's about to wage war on crime in the entire city, but he's just worried that Alfred's going to be upset or something. He doesn't really even say what he's worried about. He's clearly not sure how Alfred's going to react to him. And the Alfred just throws himself into a hug. And it was great.
Alfred's had a sweet setup for a while.
I don't know. That's a lot of house to maintain.
But,
he wants to take care
him.
Of people, though. He probably
he can
just
make tea whenever he wants.
People.
He's got just stacks of cucumber sandwiches waiting for someone to come by.
Yeah.
He was just looking out the window waiting for a car. No, I liked the whole idea of Bruce being comfortable in the cave. They added bits of I won't say Batman, kind of Batman Begins, but where they intertwine him much more with Ra's al Ghul as sort of being trained by the League of Assassins and everything. But there's a cave at Ra's base that he's much more comfortable in than the rest of the base, which he just likes the weird claustrophobic angles and the fact that it's unfinished and the fact that it's not geometrically perfect like the rest of the base. So he just liked all that. So I like that sort of through line to the end or the very last shot of the whole book is him down in the cave underneath the mansion. I just thought that was a nice little touch here.
You guys cave guys? I like a cave.
No.
I've never been in a cave with any space in it. I've only been in very, very confined caves, and I don't like that.
Yeah.
Because of how immovable the cave is. Like, you can't make more space.
If it starts to move, then you're in real trouble.
Oh, sure.
That's the problem. You don't want the cave to move while you're in it.
I've never seen a cave like this.
The guy, his buddy, who came back around.
I don't know.
Yeah, I can never remember his name. He's shown up in other books, and I don't care about him.
Does he? I don't even know. Yeah. Like, they keep calling him different things. I really like him in this. I like the idea of, this is a great way to set up a nemesis, but it's not necessarily an arch enemy. But also, I don't want to read those stories.
Right.
If that makes sense. Does that make any sense? Like it works really well for this, but I hope, because you know what's going to happen.
I think they're setting up. He's in charge of Batman Inc. now, the new issue.
Yes. I think that is. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Batman's still a mess right now, right?
Chip's writing it, and it's good.
Okay.
But it's still the overall mess of Lucius Fox has the money, and it doesn't, nothing's happened. None of it works together very well.
Yeah, I don't,
but
I don't like
that. Another great book Chip's writing is a Batman book, so. Mm-hmm. But this was true. I mean, Ryan, I think you're totally right. If this is the new origin, I'd be fine with it. I prefer Josh's idea of it's just another legend of Bruce Wayne's upbringing, and you can pick and choose, sort of like Superman Birthright versus Superman Man of Steel. But this was, like you said, Josh, every time this came out, it's like, okay, ooh, now what aspect of Bruce are we going to look at? This, and it's fun.
I think what was also good about this, and I think it's important to, and I'm curious what you guys thought, but he's with Ra's al Ghul, and this is a possibly different version of Ra's al Ghul. I'm not exactly sure. And he's, presenting himself as, a philanthropist. He's there to save the world. He's going to do the right thing. And then, you flip the page, and he's got a bunch of missiles. And
well, that is Ra's thing. He's going to save the world by cleansing it of the people who are ruining it.
But sometimes he's done as better than evil, and sometimes he's done more evil. It depends. So I didn't know what version of this was going to be. And Batman is going along with him to a certain extent. And what I wasn't sure about was if we were going to get to the point where he decides he can't be there anymore, but it's not necessarily because if something as overt as sending a bunch of missiles out. And then so the twist is just like, of course I knew about this. And he set them up to blow up, and you're like, oh, there's Batman. And that shouldn't have been a surprise to me, but it was, because I didn't know how far Batman was going to go with this as he was trying to, quote unquote, find himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been Batman all along, obviously, and had planned for the thing ahead of time. And that is the most Batman thing you can do. But it still caught me by surprise, and I liked it.
I liked the device of when he fought, is it Ghostmaker? What is this fucking guy's name?
I think that's right.
When he fought that guy early on, he choked him out. We kept flashing back to that moment where he choked him out. And the next time we saw the guy said something unintelligible. And the third time, he's the one that told Bruce he's got missiles. And so it was a nice device to show how far back, you know, Bruce has been working on this. It was good.
Yeah.
It was very good.
Yeah. It was quality issue. I think I read this first and I'd almost forgotten about it because there were so many books. But as I go back through it, yeah.
Yeah, I had like almost 30 books this week. It was a lot. So strap in, everybody.
By the way, we're about to go over the biggest oversight of the week in terms of pick of the week issues.
G.I. Joe, Real American Hero 299, the penultimate issue of the Larry Hama saga, which began in the early 80s at Marvel, is now ending at IDW. And we've been talking about this whole arc. And at some point during the week, Josh just texted me, are you reading G.I. Joe? Or did you read G.I. Joe? And then we just started talking about it. And I was like, you gotta save this, man. We got a show to do. I didn't make a pick of the week because I didn't have to, but this was definitely in the mix for pick of the week. Just, it was so ludicrous in the best possible G.I. Joe way. Josh, why don't you take it away?
You start off right away, and you know, I don't remember everything that happens, but I see you got Genghis Khan. He's in the Serpentor uniform. This is the first panel, and he's dragging Cobra Commander along the ground, and Cobra Commander is yelling, and you can hear Chris Latta. This is animated G.I. Joe. Shoot him, you laggards! Mm-hmm. You know, like he's, and everybody's kind of surprised, you know, and Serpentor is like, who do you want, him or me? And all the Cobra guys go, Serpentor, or Serpentor Khan is what they call him, which is great. Yeah. And all Dr. Mindbender asks is, can I still do my experiments? And he's like, sure. And not only, it's the middle of this battle going on, and Mindbender cannot wait to get to the lab where he's got some seriously messed up stuff in there, including a cloned homunculus body of the original Snake Eyes, who he's going to then imprint with a different personality to make him a soldier. And
well, hold on.
Okay, it's so much.
It's the personality of Snake Eyes that they got way back in the original series, if you recall,
right,
when they put him in that mind machine. I remember, I can still see the image of him, you know, with the mask over the top of his face. We never saw it, but so what they're essentially doing is they're returning Snake Eyes to the story. So this is this cloned body of the original Snake Eyes. They've got his original personality from
original uniform also,
and the original kick-ass uniform. And we see a little flashback, although I thought they showed slightly too much of his face in the flashback, but
I remember that panel though.
Yeah.
I remember that panel. It's him in his little uniform with his sunglasses on.
Right, with Scarlet coming off the boat. And so we're going to get, at the turn of the tide, like Gandalf coming over the hill, we're going to have Snake Eyes join the battle right at the end. And that was awesome. I was like,
At what point do they morph and summon any sort of Zords? I think that would make it more interesting to me.
One of the other things is that it's very easy for us to distinguish old Snake Eyes from new Snake Eyes because new Snake Eyes has a different uniform on, and everyone calls him Sean, which I think is hilarious. And I think Sean's father,
who looks 15,
is a Joe, yeah. And then he sacrifices himself to let them get. And they leave him, by the way. He's like, go without me. And they're like, all right. And like, Sean / Snake Eyes waves at him. holding an AR-15 completely incorrectly. And it's just, this is that. And then my absolute favorite panel, maybe in weeks, is they put Cobra Commander in the clink, in the brig. And he's sitting there. He's leaning back on one hand on a bench. And he has his legs crossed. And he goes, so this is languishing. I can't say I like it. And I was like, what the fuck is this? And it was just, I was like, it is all, it was, there was so much joy in reading this. I kind of went, wait, is this really happening? Can I, I sent this to a friend of mine and I was like, I know you haven't been reading this. You could just read this on his own. And like the next day he's like, that was amazing. Cause it was so good.
This was like prime,
oh
pure.
My God.
Sent it into my veins, G.I. Joe.
I'm so
everyone got a little bit. There was a little bit of great shipwreck.
Shipwreck. There was absolutely.
I wish Storm Shadow was wearing his mask just because the mask was one of the coolest sure. things when I was a kid. But, you know, crazy Dr. Mindbender resurrecting Snake Eyes, Genghis Khan in Serpentor's outfit, languishing Cobra Commander, a mutant zombie virus bomb they're going to use. Like, it's just everything that you want from G.I. Joe is happening.
How mad are you now that we haven't been reading this all along?
I mean, a little bit, but also I kind of like dropping in right at the end yeah. and just getting it the pure, you know, insanity of, yeah. the finale.
Yeah. It was so delightful. It was so subjectively delightful. But this would have been my pick of the week. 100%. Nothing made me as happy as this. Just turn the page, it's a zombie mutant bomb. Oh my God. Like, you can't drop that in a lot of places and have it not be dumb, but it was perfect there.
So I guess Sean's dad's name is Wade. What's his code name?
I don't know. He looked like a Joe.
Why does he look like he's 25?
It's not the best artist. But
how old is Sean?
That panel, isn't Sean a clone? Sean could be like 5.
True.
Who knows? That panel of Cobra Commander in the jail cell. Oh my God. It's the best thing I've ever seen.
It was really great.
That's all. That's all we need to say.
So this week we also had GCPD, The Blue Wall, number one, written by John Ridley with art by Stefano Raphael. And I mean, did you guys both read this?
I did. And it made me feel a certain kind of way about saying I wanted to see Gotham Central back.
It's just weird. I mean, it wasn't bad. I didn't think it from a story point of view. It was interesting and enjoyable, but it's just why is Rene Montoya commissioner? Why get rid of James Gordon? That's another thing they really need to fix is like, nobody wants down and out PI James Gordon, who showed up briefly in the back story of either Detective or Batman. I can't remember which book. Like, why? This doesn't add anything to the table. Like, it's kind of like when they make Falcon Captain America. It's like, are you improving this world, or are you making it less interesting by removing two interesting characters and replace them with one new character who's not as interesting as she used to be?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they've done here. It just doesn't work.
First of all, I didn't know. I was like, is she commissioner in the regular books? Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, she's an amazing character, but if you're going to show Rene Montoya in the Ascension to be...
You read Nightwing, didn't you?
Yeah.
She was in that as commissioner.
That's a lot of details.
It's what she's brain. I know.
Like, she was so self-doubting to the point of being kind of like, you know, that doesn't even seem like a police commissioner. It doesn't, like, there'd have to be some more self-confidence than that. Maybe not. I don't know. But I just kind of didn't buy it. I wanted her to have more status. I didn't want it to be another writer experiment where they're trying to deal with their own sense of self-doubt and imposter syndrome. Like, come on, it's the police commissioner. She's kick-ass. She was the question. She's like, at no time did I worry about that. There's a character, she was gay and she was confident about all of those things. So this thing is like, I don't even know if I'm supposed to be here. I was like, I'm not interested in this story. I thought that the story about the recruit who, it all made a lot of sense. She didn't shoot in a situation Parker. Where yeah. you always think, you know, like, I've read this story. She's going to shoot the kid. And she didn't. And then they decided to make political hay of it. And then you find out she was just too scared to shoot. I feel like when I read John Ridley comic books, I'm not reading a comic book about these characters or this place. I'm reading a story that he wants to tell using these characters in these places.
Okay.
It doesn't feel like Gotham Central was, it was Gotham. It was a place that you recognized. It was the thing that you recognized. And the stories were in the context of the DCU. Now, I'm not saying that those John Ridley stories are bad. He's an excellent writer. This was a really well done thing. But I don't feel like I'm reading a DC comic. I feel like I'm reading a story that's sort of vaguely set in the DC world, and I'm not there for that.
What is interesting is that, and this clearly takes place alongside of his I Am Batman book, because
yes.
there's a editor's note here. And the I Am Batman book is his is the book that was supposed to be the Batman book in the aborted new DCU that they were going to do before Dan DiDio got fired. And that's the one where Lucius Fox's kid is Batman. And the thing is, like, that I read a couple issues of that book, but I had to drop off because it was terrible. But that's a book that doesn't make any sense within the context of the current DC universe. So it almost felt like it was an Elseworlds book, but now we're seeing this is also in that world. Like, where, like, it doesn't really feel like it's part of the current DC. It feels like it's part of this side, you know.
I mean, they got a guy
Ridley-verse, for lack of a better term. It just feels like it's not in the actual DCU, because there's no way I Am Batman can take place in the actual DCU. Batman would never let someone else run around calling himself Batman in Gotham. It would never happen. And so this having being in that world feels like it's just part of his Elseworlds world he's doing, and not part of the actual DC universe, to me anyway.
I mean, they got a guy who is an Oscar-winning screenwriter, and you know, and he wants to do these Batman stories, and obviously he knows the world, but he's taking him in a different direction that doesn't seem to fit with the rest of the DCU, I guess. And you know, I saw this, and I thought, in most circumstances, I would want to read this story. This sounds like a great thing to want to read, but I know that I haven't liked any of John Ridley's Batman stuff. So, but I went for it and I read it. You know, like, I kind of got like, it's really good. You know, like it was absolutely fine construction, storytelling, and all those things. You know, but maybe I was just looking for Gotham Central.
Well, yeah, we just talked about that too.
And I mean, I couldn't quite tell if this was supposed to be Copaganda, and if it is, it's weird for John Ridley to be telling that story.
I thought that's interesting, though. I thought it was like you're taking, like, he was looking at the perspective of from both sides. He was going in, you know, in a David Simon like way. I think that's interesting. But I mean, where were you going next?
You know, we got these three recruits that we're kind of following, and they're all coming in bright eyed and bushy tailed, and they don't want to get corrupted by the system. And so it almost, I don't know, it feels a little fantastical that like these three kids are going to come into the Gotham City Police Department unscathed by the obvious levels of insane corruption that it's weird that like.
Well, they won't necessarily come out of it. True. Like we have seen the story before where, you know, a rookie cop comes in and then by the end of it is been corrupted by the system.
Was it Presbyluski in The Wire who ended up like going to be a teacher, something like that. But I just, it's strange to me that like the Gotham City PD is corrupt entirely at the level above rookie all the way to commissioner. But the rookies and the commissioners are the good guys. I'm just like, that's strange.
The rookies just haven't had a chance yet. Yeah. They literally have been in the job for like a week.
I mean, there was another story it was another book this week about like Gotham being incredibly corrupt. But it might have been this one. I don't remember.
It was the Penguin thing.
Oh, I didn't read that.
Yeah.
The idea that Gotham's police department and an entire, you know, system is entirely corrupt is cartoonish.
Yeah, it can't be.
No, but it's cartoonish. So you have to have your disbelief with that right along with everything about Batman that doesn't make sense. And so.
But it's also kind of like the Chicago Police Department in the 1920s. Yes. Like, you know. Think about Untouchables. Like most of the cops, or a good portion, were owned by. Well, I just watched Untouchables, like Capone. But then you had the small pocket of Malone's guys who aren't corrupt. So they're if the GCPD was entirely corrupt, the city would collapse on.
But
itself.
I always felt
there has to be pockets of cops that are actually not corrupt on.
And I always felt like Gordon has his pocket of guys. And I think to Josh's point about Montoya being so uncertain about everything, she doesn't feel. I don't feel like she's got her pocket of people. Maybe that's where the story is going.
You have no power.
Yeah.
Well, it's shown visually. There's that scene after she gives a speech, and all the brass is like congratulating her, and they're drawn like demons. Mm-hmm. You know, on page five.
That's pretty nice.
It's sort of shown that's kind of what it is. She's in the midst of.
And then I just thought, from a publishing perspective, it was strange. It was strange that this book had a content warning at the front of the book. And then it black bars out all the curse words except the one racial slur that was for the content warning.
I think the content warning was the racial slur. Oh, yeah, no, but yeah.
Okay. I know, but to me, that was just a weird choice. Like, if you want to use racial slurs and curse words, like, can just make this a Black Label book. And you could still have the content warning. It just felt weird to, like.
I think that's a stylistic choice that I don't entirely disagree with, but I think it's weird. Can I tell you that this book had, I think, the stupidest line of the week?
Go on.
And it was, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but it was, for as long as I can remember, I always wanted to be a parole officer. Like, one of them says that. I guess I never really wanted to be anything other than a parole officer. And I was like, no one in history has ever said that.
Well, I mean, it's a freeze frame, just like Goodfellas, because all comic book panels are technically freeze frames.
I don't know how law enforcement works like this, but do you go through the police academy to become a parole
officer? I didn't think so. I did think that that was a different department for sure. Like that's a corrections thing or even like social work or something like that.
Like he's there with them as a rookie cadet. And then later on we see him like in a polo shirt. And I was like, what's this guy doing? What group is he in?
They were talking about how they graduated. He's like, oh, he's going to be a parole officer, which on his face is stupid. And then
That's not necessarily
not stupid, but like I don't feel like that's a job that people aspire to. I mean, it's possible.
Well, it might be. Every
parent
job
was
is
in the prison or whatever. Whatever. But then in the context of him just graduating from the police academy, I was like, well, that doesn't make sense. I could be wrong. I didn't do the research. I didn't write the thing, but it struck me.
According to this article, in some jurisdictions, there may be certified law enforcement officials who have completed mandated police academy training to serve as parole officers.
That's not the same thing as police training, though.
But it says police academy training.
Police academy training.
Mandated police academy training. But maybe it's one of those things where like they make you take classes with the other people or whatever, but you don't necessarily graduate the same thing. You couldn't also then just go be a patrol
officer. It seems a weird system if the same, like if there's one academy that's training beat cops, detectives, SWAT team members, and parole officers. Right. Like it feels like there should be separate systems for those different roles.
And maybe that's it. I don't know. It just was very strange. I mean, obviously there's some story reason to have this guy be a parole officer. And, you know, his stories about...
Well, he's
one of the kid he's talking to at the basketball court is the kid at the end of the end of the book with the gun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just examining different facets of law enforcement. It was a strange book. I didn't dislike it, but it was strange. I don't know. Is it an ongoing book? Oh, we don't know.
It's the first issue, Connor.
Sticking with it?
Maybe.
Yeah, I'm going to read the second issue.
I think I'm a maybe on this one.
Another great book this week, I thought, was Rogues. The final issue of Rogues, Black Label Book 4. The final issue of the Rogues doomed heist in Gorilla City. And I liked it. I thought it was very good. I thought this whole miniseries has been terrific. I think it's been pick of the week 2 out of 4 issues, maybe, at least once.
And it was in the running for this week as well. I thought this was an excellent wrap-up issue. I think there's something especially compelling about when the heist, you know, it's the Dog Day Afternoon. Like the heist has gone, or it wasn't even a heist in Dog Day Afternoon, but like I guess it was a robbery. It's gone so badly that like we as the audience can see clearly there's no way out for the characters involved. And it's the characters themselves because they're living through this story and are in moments of desperation are throwing every Hail Mary pass they can to try to make something work. And you just can see Len Snart making all the wrong decisions.
Right. But we're comic
back after back after back.
So we're used to the idea that when things look impossible, then that's when the hero or protagonist will pull through. And so when that does not happen, I was like, oh, shit, which is different than I had when I saw Rogue One. I had the problem with the movie that was like, I knew everyone was going to die at the end. I knew they were going to succeed in the thing. And this, I didn't know what was going to happen, but I think my inborn expectations were not that they would all get killed or lose. Or like, I thought you can't do that because you've set up the rogues to be various levels of reformed or good, you know, like Len's sister and Tiger Guy.
Tiger King.
No, there you go.
Bronze Tiger.
Tiger King's got a mullet.
Either way, you know, like to have it all just fall apart and that's the end of it. I was like, I mean, it makes sense, but I didn't expect it. It was a good reversal.
Yeah, I was genuinely shocked when the sister and is it Bronze Tiger?
Yes.
Whatever his name is.
Tiger
Bomb. They got killed. I just thought that, you know, sometimes you let the good characters make it through, right? But other times it's the tragic end, and this is where what happens. They return Grodd's baby to the mother, and they're like, fuck it, let's get out of here and live a better life. And then boom, 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 they get shot.
I'm glad the kid, Grodd's kid, didn't have a dark ending. I was...
kid was way too cute to have a dark ending. He kept looking into my soul with his big eyes.
The moment that shocked me was when Snart broke the mirror gun. Because that was when I realized, like, oh, okay, yeah, they're fucked. There's no out.
they make the point. It was obviously, like, part of the clear theme of the thing was that, like, Snart's bad news. If you get mixed up with him, you will also be bad news. And they've been saying it the whole time. But you're just so... You're prepared in heroic stories to think there's going to be some sort of heroic comeuppance or something good will come out of it. Like, who wins here? Grodd? The bait? You know, baby? It's not... No one.
I mean, Grodd gets his kid back, but he loses all his money. And I like
also says in front of his wife, I'll just have another one.
Not great.
It's I like that the book. I like that this issue starts off with, you know, Len Snart talking about being unhoused with his sister as a kid, and how the rich folks on their way to the office jobs were never charitable, but the blue collar workers are. And it plays into this, I think, self-made mythology that Lensnart has about himself, that he's blue collar. And then by the end of the book, he's, you know, betrayed all of the people that were supposed to be his like sort of blue collar allies. And then it cuts back to the bar where they all hang out and everybody's just like, yeah, Lensnart, that dude sucked. Like he was out for himself. He wasn't out for the rest of us. He didn't actually have those values.
And I thought that was to sort of go back to the David Simon sort of like Wire season two or whatever. You know, some of those guys get mixed up in crime or whatever, but they're sort of saying, well, this is the thing they come from. And this is like, there's no inherent nobility about Lensnart, even though he believes it to be there and other people look for it. Like, he's a bad dude. Mm-hmm. Even though he came from this place of, you know,
he's putting eggs in his morning beer, for crying out loud.
Well, he's a fighter.
Yeah.
Apparently my great grandfather used to do that, put an egg in the beer.
It was good. It ended up wrapping up really well. I mean, this is one of the better things that Josh Williamson has written in a while. I thought this was a really nice self-contained piece that
guy contains multitudes, ending. Man. He can do superhero stuff that doesn't really make an impact. But to be fair, like, I think, you know, he had a great, great, great run on Flash. The Robin series that he just wrapped up was really good. You know, Dark Crisis is apparently a comic book. But also that is what it is. Like, if you're into that kind of comic book, I bet you think that's great.
No, I am. I'm into that kind of comic book, and it's terrible. Let's take a quick break here and talk about how, if you enjoy this show and the various shows we do here at iFanboy, which is a lot of different kind of shows, if you enjoy those shows and they make your comic book reading experience better and more fun, please consider supporting our various our network of shows. And there's various ways you can do that. The first and most beneficial way is to become a patron at patreon.com/iFanboy. Those people have unlocked many of the shows we do. They've given everyone more shows to listen to, and they've helped make everything better by making our system bigger and more interesting. And we appreciate them. They're fun to hang out with on a monthly basis, and we like having them around. They're good people. We have stretch goals. We're actually I've been editing a spreadsheet with new ideas. We're going to go over that and present them soon. We're going to switch things up a bit. We've had the same stretch goal since we started, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. So we're gonna make, you know, hopefully make things more interesting for you, and hopefully you'll consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/iFanboy. So thank you for that. iFanboy.threadless.com is where you can buy our t-shirts. We've got 12 designs. I mean, there's other products and services and goods and sundries you can get the designs on, but most people buy t-shirts. You can find that at iFanboy.threadless.com. iFanboy.com/support is where you can tip via PayPal. iFanboy.com/Amazon is where you can find the Booksplode books, as well as a general Amazon shopping link, and bookshop.org. You'll find those links sometimes around the website, depending on what we're talking about, where you can buy books through them and help support local bookstores. And it's a great service, and we do appreciate everyone who helps support iFanboy shows in various ways. We literally could not do it without you, so thank you very much.
I can specifically say they've added a lot of support to my life, the iFanboy patrons, and I really appreciate it in a bunch of different ways. But you know, if you don't think that this matters and doesn't help, trust me, it does. And not only just like I will say, like, there's been iFanboy people who've been so awesome to me in the past couple of months, and it's all part of this community, and very proud of it. Thank you.
Great community. So, Public Domain 5 is this seems like the final issue of this arc. I saw earlier he's doing another arc, but he hasn't done it yet. So this is the final issue for now.
It's one of those, I wouldn't have seen this coming as a thing based on all the other work that Chip Zdarsky's doing. I sounded drunk there. Chip Zdarsky's doing. and, you know, he's doing all, I don't know where this guy sleeps, but when.
Yeah, you got to strike while the iron's hot.
You know, you do, and he is, and it's like there, I can't think of a big whiff or anything out of all this stuff, but this is so different than the other things. But it's one of those, you know, most comic writers or artists have a making comic story or a comic business story. And then we've all, you know, mm-hmm. Bendis has done one. They've all done one. Chaykin made a little thing on it for a while. And there's this little bit in here with the end that stuck out to me, is that, like, the one brother who looks like Chip Zdarsky,
he's an asshole.
And he's like, I don't want to be this kind of writer. You know, and then there's the other girl who all she ever wanted to be was this kind of writer. And you go back and you see her, I think her Korean family was like, you can't have her do this. You know, it's sort of almost stereotypical, like, this is, you have to be a doctor, you know, whatever it is, you know, and she's always been touched by the comics, and that's what she's always wanted to do. You know, there's just enough leeway to be silly, the goofy fan who's over there all the time. And listen, we know that fan. Like, I've seen that guy.
But listen, they found their eccentric billionaire.
They did, exactly.
It was a little bit of a deus ex machina where this fan who's always hanging around and always getting the dad to sign stuff is actually incredibly wealthy and decides to fund their publishing company for a year. Like, it was a little bit of that, but, you know, whatever. That's a thing that happens. Right.
No, it was funny, though, because they opened the doors. It was all furnished. And my instinct was like, that can't have happened already. Like I thought that was just like
comic logic. I thought we had to jump forward.
Yeah. And no, it's just this dude. But, you know, that all came from the fact that, and I can't help but love it, is that the dad, the beloved comic book artist who has no avarice about him at all, he really just does it for the joy of comic books, has just always been nice to him. He gives him books. Mm-hmm. He won't let him pay him. He signs stuff. He just likes that this person likes the work and likes
And I love that juxtaposed with the guy, the other guy who wants to come out of retirement out of spite. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody's kind of treating him as like, okay, I guess the old man's going to like take up an office space again, but we're not really going to let him do anything.
Yeah.
Josh, did you see that somebody in the Discord pointed out that Chip did confirm that there's a lot of color theory going on here, and he purposefully designs these pages to have certain colors in certain places for certain reasons?
I didn't, but cool.
So, yeah, no, you nailed it.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things, we can't go too long, one of my favorite things with this issue was that, like, the dad isn't good anymore.
I bumped on that because I saw that drawing and I was like, I don't know, that looks fine to me. And they're all like, oh no, this is going to be terrible. And then I should have seen the inker, the tattoo artist becoming the inker, as it was obvious in retrospect, but yeah, well done.
This book shouldn't be any good. Like, if I described it to you, you'd be like, that sounds terrible. If I described some of the beats to you, you'd be like, that's awful. But it's also incredibly realistic. Like, hey, a lot of these guys don't have it anymore, or what they have isn't what you want anymore.
Right. Like, the drawing is good, but like, it's not going to sell comics.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
People aren't going to buy a comic drawn like that. So they take the Sun ink over it and make it look modern. Same thing with the writer. He's there. He's like, I'm coming back. I'm going to make, you know, I'm going to handle everything. And the employees are like, fuck, this guy can't do it anymore. Like, it's just the things move on.
He doesn't know what a fax machine is, which is cheap, but you know.
No, he has a fax machine. Doesn't know what other stuff is.
Well, he wants to fax the pages to the artist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just it was an interesting way looking into the generational shift. I mean, we certainly know many, many old time comic artists who still have it.
Yeah.
Writers who still have it, but sometimes they don't. You know.
Right.
Stan Lee's stuff was terrible after a certain point.
I'd really be interested in the sort of stories behind where this came from, if anything. Like, you know, did. It was either Chip sort of had sort of a mentor or knew about a story about somebody who was, or what, you know, like all that Howard Chaykin stuff comes from stories that have been passed around one way or another. And this is probably an amalgam of things, but it's really interesting me try to figure out. I was like, oh, is this guy like Walt Simonson? I mean, I don't think he has, but it reminds me of that because he's just such a good dude.
I assume, Josh, that you read Deadly Neighborhood Spider-Man number one because of Juan Ferreyra.
I did. I read Deadly Neighborhood Spider-Man number
one. That's not how you say his name, by the way.
Because of Juan Ferreyra. There's an R missing there. Ferreyra.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I did. I believe I've never heard of the writers Taboo and B. Earl, which makes me think of Toe Jam and Earl for some reason. Taboo and B. Earl.
Wow, dust off your Sega Genesis, everybody.
The idea, that game was great. It was like a hip-hop based, I don't know.
For whatever reason, as a kid, I was very grossed out by it.
That was one of the first games of my life that I was blown away by. I was like, I've never seen anything like this. And it was funny. Games weren't funny. Anyway, I'm not doing that.
So Taboo was from the Black Eyed Peas.
No kidding.
Yes.
Based on this book, Spider-Man cannot claim to have a full week bear free. Yeah.
So the idea is that this is like the dark Spider-Man story. So he's got like flamey eyes or whatever. And I'm going to be honest, this story wasn't awesome. Didn't make a ton of sense. Like, Spider-Man flew to LA to play chess with a friend and basically he's having these like hallucinations. He fights.
No, he's there to work on like some project with like sound with a collaborator.
I thought he was going to visit. It doesn't matter. Like the script wasn't awesome. He was pretty quippy. It wasn't like off brand, but it was like a little, like a generation back of where it needed to be in terms of that. But again, I read this because of Juan Ferreyra and the entire thing was justified by basically, they're trying to figure out the key to this science experiment that they're working on, and he, for some reason, gets clued into the Fibonacci sequence, right? There's one page in this book that takes place in a spiral formation, and the panels get smaller and smaller as you go in. And in the last panel, they're super tiny. And it was my favorite page of the week. Like, by far. I looked to see it was available for purchase. And I don't have money.
Better than Cobra Commander. And
I'm also going to look up that page. I'm guessing that goes for less. But either way, I just thought it's one of those, like Ferreira has such a great visual imagination. And I looked for that page, I started looking through other pages of his, and they just stand out all over the place. That one page, I thought, oh, you've just done a visual representation of the mathematical concept that they're talking about. And like, it looked fine. It looked great. Like he draws what he draws. It depends on the script a lot of the time, but that one page really did it for me. And that's, I wanted to make sure I didn't let it go.
Well, he was the artist that did that Spider-Man Marvel Infinity comic, the scroller. Yeah. And it was very inventive visually.
Yeah,
it has to be if you get to read that.
Yep.
B. Earl is an American Indian writer who wrote had a story in the Indigenous Voices special, and then did an arc of Werewolf by Night. Hmm. So he's a new writer.
Okay.
And Taboo again is from Black Eyed Peas.
Cool.
Deadly Class 56 is the final issue, and we just talked last week and on the 850 show about where are the long indie arcs, and really it's sort of dying out with Rick Remender's books. So he had, Black Science went around this many issues. 56 is basically 60, which used to be the standard run on these stories. So Deadly Class may be it for a while, and this is it for him and Rick Remender and Wes Craig. I think Wes Craig drew every issue. I think.
Oh yeah, I think so.
Pretty sure.
I mean, I don't know. I haven't read it, but
he actually. I mean, the main characters, Miguel and Maria, get their revenge on the people that have been tormenting them from the class. We're now in 2023 in the book. And there's a conversation about, will we have a happy ending? And the conversation is, well, no one gets a happy ending. Eventually, everyone dies. And it all depends on when you stop telling the story. Like, do you stop at the happy point, or do you take it to the extent of everyone dying? And it's sad. So he allowed, it's sort of a meta commentary. And he stops the story with them on the couch together, having a nice moment. And then we flash back to them as all kids, and all their friends who are now dead are, alive again. And it's just a dumb teenage conversation they're having on the way to like a party. And it sort of recaptured, them in their prime when they were, all still friends, all still alive, still to school. And Miguel's being in his head and being sort of mopey and fatalistic. They're going to Denny's, actually, not a party. They're leaving a party, going to Denny's. And they all just sort of make fun of him for being so mopey. And it was a nice way to end the story where he and his wife get to, kiss on the couch and have a happy ending. And then we flash back to them as kids and everyone's happy. And it was really just really nice. It was a good ending. Endings are hard. And he's done a really good job with his.
Yeah, he's a good endinger person.
Yeah. It was a great book. It really was the whole way through. I really liked it. Deadly Class a lot.
Flashpoint Beyond number 6 is the end of this arc, I believe, written by Jeff Johns, Tim
book.
Sheridan, and Jeremy Adams. I think it's the end of the book as well. It's kind of, this feels
6 of 6 on the cover.
This feels like a throwbacky book in that there was a time when Jeff Johns put a bunch of stuff on a chalkboard in the background of a scene, that was like a week's worth of content on the internet. And I don't think we're there anymore. So I don't know why I read this.
Well, I mean, this is not bad. Out of continuity. It's out of continuity. It's not, he's not the main player in DC anymore. So he gets to be off sort of on the side doing whatever. That doesn't really affect anything else. So that's why, it doesn't make any sort of impact because this
but
is it, not.
It's, yeah, DC. It's Batman versus Rip Hunter, and Batman has the entire Flashpoint universe in a snow globe. And so that pocket universe gets to exist. Even though Rip Hunter wants to destroy it. And then suddenly there's now a character named Nostalgia based off of Adrian Veidt's perfume.
Yeah. I mean, he's for whatever reason, he's intent on keeping Watchmen around, but it doesn't make a difference. It's just not affecting anything else. I mean, the thing you're talking about is the page where all these 13 people are who are being kept alive by the time cops.
Yes.
Get sent back into the DCU. And
there was a chalkboard in a previous issue though.
Right. This is just characters for, looks like it's JSA books, like the Golden Age Aquaman and Judy Garrick and, the Golden Age Legionnaire. So it's just going to be, it's just going to affect whatever his JSA, which I'm very excited for.
It's so strange to have these books coming out And, you know, when he first started doing like his Doomsday Clock stuff, it was contemporaneous with the Watchmen TV show. And so it's just strange to see like a different medium do Watchmen better than the successor comics have been able to do it.
Well, it's just this one book. I mean, you know, the before Watchmen stuff was, some of it was really terrific.
Yeah, that feels like a distant memory at this point. I guess you could say I have a bottle of nostalgia for that.
So those are the comics we wanted to talk about. There's a lot of comics. Could have talked about a lot more, but we don't have the time. But the patrons get their say. They have the patron pick. Every patron gets a vote to add a book to the rundown. And this week's winner, speaking of nostalgia, it was Miracle Man, The Silver Age, number one, written by Neil Gaiman, art by Mark Buckingham, colors by Jordi Belair, letters by Todd Klein. And Josh, when is it? We did that video show on Miracle Man like 12 to 13 years ago.
Yes.
And that was the last time I read Miracle Man.
Yes.
We read the entire Alan Moore run.
And a little, did we read, was, I guess Alan Moore, we didn't read the Neil Gaiman bits.
Not for the show.
Right.
Is this the original stuff? I just don't know. I didn't do, you know, poor planning. I didn't look up what this actually is.
I was expecting you to. I wasn't sure about it, but when I started reading it, I think this is new, unless they radically went in and sort of remastered it, because it doesn't look like comics mm-hmm. looked then. It's not how the coloring would have been. It's not.
It's Jordi Belair.
Yeah. So I think this is a new story, which is really interesting because, I mean, the thing that struck me right away was I remember when Joe Quesada announced at Comic-Con that they had gotten the Miracle Man rights, and it was like a huge deal. And then what happened was nothing.
For years.
Until now, basically. Did they even reprint them? Like, is that a thing?
They did.
Okay.
They did. There's
collections
of them. So,
like, they're available now for reading. And I know that, you know, the big story. No, that's something else. You know, like, it just didn't really happen. And so to have a Miracle Man story come out this week, and I think it's new. We can. But that was my.
No. It's. I'm looking at it now. It's. This is remastered.
No shit.
The first two issues are remastered, and after that, they'll be new.
Okay, that makes sense because I don't think it finished. So, okay, but that on its own is really interesting because this feels like a modern comic. Yeah. I would 100% believe that it was done now. Mark Buckingham. Looks like Mark Buckingham. You know what I mean? Like, you read this or you read Fables, like, he's, you know, he's still got his thing going on. And I was totally, into it. I was compelled. I'm not going to tell you it's like the greatest comic I've ever read, but once I got my feet under me and I sort of recognized where I was and kind of remembered all those bits. And I will tell you that the exact moment that I thought was my favorite is, what's his name? Is it Kid Miracle
Man? The names
Man
are confusing and not. Yeah, it's like there's Miracle Man, there's Miracle Young Man, Miracle Man.
Kid Miracle Man, Young Miracle Man. Kid Miracle Man was the villain in the
original
series.
So this is Young Miracle Man, YMM.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, I'm tired. And he goes in to meet everybody and he's like, what was that? There was a black guy. There was a whore in a swimsuit. And you're like, oh, he's got 60s or like maybe even 40s because it's supposed to be 40 years later. And this would have been done in the 80s. Like his
prejudices.
Yes, his understanding of the world are based on, you know, things 40 years prior.
No, he's from the 50s. The character himself died in the 50s. So he's like, why is there a black guy there?
Right.
Who's the Jezebel? And like, it's just like, whoa,
okay. Which is, I just, like, that really struck me, you know, because we have this idea about, like, how Captain America comes out of the ice and he's the greatest guy in the world. Well, this guy comes out of the ice and he's got 50 sensibilities and it ain't good.
Right.
You know, and I guess that's part of the thing is that, like, the utopia that these other characters are all living right now, granted they live in the house of the Overlord, you know, it's pretty diverse. It's pretty, like, modern, you know, in that sense. I really liked that bit, and I liked, you know, everything you know is wrong. I like how Miracle Man was trying to be like, well, let's kind of roll it out to you slowly. But I guess we can't. We're in a comic book. You know, like, it was...
It's interesting. We talked about this a bit on the Miracle Man show itself. And that book, which, by the way, you just go to YouTube and go to our page and you can find it. That book is terrific. That Alan Moore book is legitimately terrific. However, it couldn't help but to be disappointing for people who had never read it before. Because it was this legendary comic that no one was able to read for rights reasons. Mm-hmm. It was never reprinted and hard to find back issues. They were really, really hard to find for a while. And so it just got this legendary status of this lost Alan Moore book that was so terrific and no one could read it. And so when people did, they often were like, that's it. Because at the end of the day, it was a fine book. I really enjoyed the Alan Moore stuff, but I wouldn't put it in his top, you know, level of books. So it often becomes disappointing for people. And so then I don't know if there's actually like an audience for this.
I agree.
Who cares? You know, it was almost better as this legend than it was in reality.
I think one of the other things too is that I think really cool things happen in that book and they're unexpected, but it set a tone to a certain extent. And so those things were then done again later by others. And so it feels like something you've read before. It was the first one who did it, you know, the sort of big villain turn, you know, mm-hmm. not the first one, but done in that sort of, I'm air quoting, modern style. It's a real trendsetter in a way, and it affected people. You know, the art was, you know, way ahead of where art was at the time. It did a lot of things right, but it influenced so many things it did them afterwards. So by the time that most people got to go back and read it, if you're not reading in the context of what it is, when it came out, what else was going on, it's going to maybe feel underwhelming.
Right. It's like people who hear music from the 60s or old movies, right. Like, what's the big deal? And it's like, well, that because without this, nothing else happens.
It's but like people say the Beatles.
It's just movies. Interesting. I just don't know if that people really care. I don't
have a ton of context for. I haven't read the original Alan Moore stuff. Mm-hmm. I watched your show when it came out, but I was coming into this relatively fresh in terms of knowing.
I'm really curious. This must have been like complete nonsense.
I mean, it wasn't that bad because it's playing on tropes that I'm familiar enough with that I could keep up, and I know the general I know the generalities of Miracle Man. I haven't dove deep into the story, so I was able to follow along, and I would say I even enjoyed it. It wasn't, you know, it was a well constructed comic. Gaiman and Bucky still have it, so I really enjoyed Mark Buckingham's sketchbook at the end. That's not normally a part of these books that I spend a lot of time on, but I thought his thoughts on the different designs of the costumes and updating them, and his color theory work, and even how he uses Legos to build the buildings that he has to draw so he can look at them in 3D. I was like, that's neat.
That is neat.
Yeah, that was interesting. I don't know. It was just a weird book. I didn't know if I liked it or didn't like it or didn't care. Like, it was, there were interesting scenes for sure. Like the scene, Josh, you mentioned, that was the best scene. It's like, oh, that's interesting. And I've never read that scene before. Or at least I can't remember reading that scene before. Yeah. But overall, I was like, I don't know what this is or if anyone is like supposed to, like, how is anyone supposed to enjoy this fully without having read everything that's come before, and how many people have actually read everything that's come before? And just weird.
I think the other thing that's interesting is that like Marvel is clearly treating this like something that's very special and important, but going back to what you said, it's not to most people. It is, yeah. If you are a comic book historian or like the lover of comic book history and you like really, but you know, we've been on the internet long enough now that if you wanted to read something so bad, you would have. I mean, that's how I read it. You know, like, I couldn't get the issues. So, wait, we can, I mean, like, I don't feel bad downloading issues of a book that you could not
get. But we read, I mean, yeah. The issues, our buddy Tad Stone sent us the run. That's how we read it for the show, was we read all the physical issues. And I had bought most of them off of eBay by that point.
Yeah, yeah.
After a while, I just sort of been collecting them slowly but surely. Who ended up with those issues? Them. You have them.
I have a lot of great comics from Tad. They're my favorite.
Well, at least you have them. I was worried that they went out the door with my stuff. I was like, oh, shit, who has those issues? I'm glad you have them. I don't know. It's just weird. I just don't think there's any call or clamoring for this to finish. Some things are just better left to history. Like,
yes.
Like, that was this strange, cool book that went away, and if you can find it, great. But no one's really. Listen,
if something is 40 years old and it's famous for never having finished and not have an ending, and you say, we're going to tell the ending, you've fucked up already.
Unless your name is George R.R. Martin, in which case, please keep at it. We're all rooting for you.
He hasn't stopped working on it.
I know.
Working on it very slowly.
I'm here for it whenever it arrives.
Yeah,
I'm excited for it, but he's the exception.
Yeah, no,
but Neil Gaiman is terrific, obviously. Yes. Duh. So, but even then, it's like at the time I wasn't really interested in reading his issues. Like, it was Alan Moore's
right
thing. He finished his story. And it didn't need to keep going.
And it's proto Alan somebody Moore. Else. It's reading like, oh wow, this guy did have it, which is setting him up to do these amazing things that he did later. Like, it's really good. You can see it. It's all on the page. You're right. It's not his best stuff. It's like listening to the earliest Beatles albums. You know, you go, okay, right, there's a thing here that's cool, and it's setting up for him to do Abbey Road, which is going to be amazing. I know what you're saying, and I agree with you. But the point being, like, it's an earlier point in the progression. Music often doesn't work.
I mean, it was the same thing he did, like Marvel Man, which was the original name, and I don't know why they're not going back to it, because that was like part of the whole thing about getting it back. But Marvel Man was from the 50s. It was a character that Alan Moore reappropriated in 1982,
which was a ripoff of Captain Marvel. I mean, like, it's all.
Yeah, this is a Captain Marvel.
And when I say a ripoff, like, I don't mean like, oh, it's very similar. I mean, they were literally going, let's just do that, but change it a little bit so we don't.
And Captain Marvel was a ripoff of Superman. I mean, there was a lot of it was the style at the time.
It was like an onion on your belt.
So, how do we rate this?
Thank you for catching that reference, Josh.
No problem.
I don't know.
I'm going to go straight up because I don't really know another way to do it. So I'm going to go on my sort of enjoyment of the thing, tying back to a thing that I think is a really interesting part of comic book history and a pretty good story that we're still talking about. 3.75. Which feels high when I say it out loud, but I'm interested. And when I was done, I was like, okay, you have my attention.
Ryan?
I think given the sort of mythic and miraculous nature of the thing and the somewhat irrationality surrounding its publication, I'm going to give this a rating of pi, a irrational number beginning with 3.14 and a lot more numbers after that forever.
Interesting.
Just feels right.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with 3 out of 5. I didn't dislike it, but I was like, wow, man, this is, I've really had to work hard to remember anything.
If this had come out when they got the rights, I mean, that must be at least 10 years ago. I want to say.
Oh, way more, more. Like we were at the convention working. We were shooting a video show. Right. And so that had to be, 12 or 13 years ago.
And like the rumor around that time was like Alan Moore was going to come work at Marvel again. Just absurd.
Which, by the way, if you looked at the house ad for the trades, his name is not on those books.
Yeah, but that's,
it's just
because he doesn't want it there. But like the point is, if this had come out then, I think it would be a whole other thing. And I mean, it's so long, it's like the comeback no one asked for.
Right.
Yeah. But I enjoyed it. I will read it. I am going to read the next one. Connor, are you going to keep going?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. Okay, I looked it up. 2009.
Yeah, that's about right.
Was when they got the rights.
13 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, nobody who would have cared about that point is even reading comics anymore. Except us.
Oh, boy. All right. Yeah, I don't know. I may or may not. I have not decided, honestly. I'm sort of punting that question just because I don't.
Great Todd Klein on letters.
It's a great week for letters.
Always.
So there you go. Patron pick, patreon.com/FMboy. Every patron votes to add a book to the rundown. Thanks for voting. Thanks for being a patron. But if you're a patron at the $5 or higher level, you get a superpower bestowed upon you as if from the gods above, live on the show. And this week, it's Ryan's turn.
I don't think I said if I was sticking with it, and my answer is probably not.
Sorry.
Oh, I thought you were going to be a yes. That's why I asked him, because I was sure. I figured you'd keep going.
No, I think if I was going to, I mean, this might spur me to go back and read the original Alan Moore run, but that's not likely to happen before the next issue of this comes out. And I feel like I'll use that as an excuse not to.
That, I mean, that's worth
I will say
it.
It's, yeah, I was going to say it's totally worth it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Go ahead.
Gilbert can manifest $1,000 inside any unopened 28-ounce can of San Marzano tomatoes.
The best part was there was a text earlier during the show where he's like, I think I figured it out. And I thought, it's going to relate to something we talked about. And it did not.
No, it did. Because you know what I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, Josh?
San Marzano tomatoes?
A bear.
That's true.
So Gilbert is the name of the patron. And as long as he has that.
They have to be real San Marzano tomatoes. They can't be, because a lot of places will sell you San Marzano style tomatoes? No.
We all watched the show on CNN with the actor in the San Marzano region.
Yeah,
that's not what I meant. Who's the actor? Stanley Tucci. He goes to San Marzano and talks about the tomatoes, the whole thing.
Yeah, the Tucci.
That sounds great.
Love the Tucci.
All right. Well, there you go. Thanks, Gilbert. You now have an unending supply of $1,000 if you can find those tomatoes. Patreon.com/FMboy. Thanks for being a patron, Gilbert. And let's quickly do an email because we got Ryan here. And it's for him. The question is from Brad G. from Exeter, California. And Brad says, science question for Ryan. I've been thinking about this question for 4 minutes and 34 seconds after reading Batman Superman World's Finest number 7. That was the last issue, not this week's. Where it says, Superman's cells process solar energy differently on Earth than humans. I'm inferring that means Superman processes the solar energy to make energy he can use a la photosynthesis. Does this mean Superman and Kryptonians are part plants, or do they just use photosynthesis?
This is something we actually...
Wait. Before you say anything, I'm now setting a timer for 4 minutes and 34 seconds. Should you go over this by any moment, we are done with the question. Go.
Okay. I love it. I love that for us. This was something we debated heavily in the early days of my podcast, Science Sort Of. In episode 9, we had a physicist on to explain his grand unified theory of Superman's powers. His name is Ben Tippett. He's now a good friend of mine. But that ignited a discussion of the source of Superman's energy. I have been a staunch opponent of the photosynthesis theory simply because Superman is not green, and photosynthesis here on Earth occurs using organelles called chloroplasts, and they are green because the spectra of light emitted by the sun is at its most absorbable within like the green wavelength area. So it's this weird thing of like if plants evolved on other solar systems with different colored suns, they'd probably have different colored plants because they kind of evolved to optimize the light spectra being emitted from the sun for them. And photosynthesis is a very specific sequence of chemical reactions that turns carbon dioxide using stellar energy or photons into a simple sugar called glucose. So one carbon, two hydrogen and oxygen, and then it produces oxygen and water as a byproduct. So I don't think, you know, Superman is not green, nor is he like simply producing glucose as a simple sugar. Like he's producing this wide suite of powers. So I have long since advocated for the idea that Kryptonians are photovoltaic, which
three
is
minutes
just,
remaining.
And I'm wrapping this up. I'm nearly done.
So he's like a human. He's like a human solar panel.
More like a human solar panel than a human plant. One really interesting quirk on this whole thing that I do want to point out is that there are animals on Earth that photosynthesize. My favorite example is there's this sea slug called Alesia chlorotica that when it first hatches, it eats this algae that it doesn't fully digest, and it actually incorporates the chloroplasts of the algae into its own cells. So when it's in its adult form, it has cells in its body that it has absorbed from algae that are actively photosynthesized to provide it food. So it's this green slug that has figured, it's an animal that has figured out how to co-opt photosynthesis for their own purposes, which is really cool. And I think in the comics, Krypton is usually portrayed as orbiting a red star. It's unclear. Yeah. In college, I took a class on stellar evolution, which was fascinating. Or I took an astronomy class that covered a lot of stellar evolution. And so there's two kinds of red stars. There's red giants and red supergiants. It's unclear to me type of star Krypton orbits. But either of those stars would be larger and older than our star. They would probably be more luminous. They probably throw off more light. But part of that depends on...
What do you think the odds are that Jerry Siegel took a class like that? Or just made it up?
Well, I think Krypton is also meant to be a more massive planet than Earth. So like Kryptonian muscles would have developed under a higher amount of gravity. And then the idea I think was always that like Kryptonians are getting older light because they have an older star. So when they come to this younger solar system, that's what kind of wakes up their cells and gives them this extra boost of energy. I double checked the issue, the number 7 World's Finest, and the character that is processing light similarly that they're making reference to is from Gotham, and the scene where he's getting launched into space, Gotham has that classic red sky. So I also wonder if there's like an atmospheric effect that's preventing all the light from whatever star they're orbiting from getting down to the planet's surface that's also helping these people like suppress their powers on their home planet, but allows their powers to come to full force on Earth.
Hmm.
So that's my thoughts.
I was watching the clock. I didn't hear most of it.
So he's not photosynthesis, he's photovoltaic.
That's been my argument, but I think there's room for discussion. I'm not claiming I have the perfect answer here.
Has anybody considered the actual correct answer?
That it's actually Clark who's been filling up the Batmobile's tires this entire time with his super
comic
breath.
Books.
I need to know who's filling up the Batmobile's tires with air, Josh.
It's comic books.
I need to know.
Alfred. Contact at fanboy.com is how you can write in like Brad. Thanks for writing in. We appreciate
it. Yeah, good question.
Let's do some plugs and get out of here. We mentioned earlier in the show, but just behind the show on the feed, we put out a new Booksplode review this past week. Oh, Josh and I looked at Cosmic Odyssey, the 1988 miniseries from Jim Starlin and early Mike Mignola. And we had a great time talking about that. It went longer than I thought it would. And it's a fun book and a fun conversation. You can find that show right behind this one on the feed. Sometime soon, there'll be a review of Black Adam. Not sure when. It's set to come out later this week, probably Thursday. If you listen to the show early in the week, but that's about when we're aiming for it. We have to go see it and we have to review it, and hopefully that comes out then. And then later, actually not this month, it's going to come out a few days into November. It will be the October Media Splode, just because of scheduling. We got screwed. We want to talk about House of the Dragon. We want to talk about Lord of the Rings, and House of the Dragon just doesn't end. It's just, there's just too many shows we're doing, and House of the Dragon screwed us. So it's going to come out the very first.
Hot D did.
So we're gonna. It's going to come out November 3rd, and then you'll have another media splode just a few weeks later. But that's just the way it goes. We had a lot of scheduling really screwed us. This
Talking week. Targs with the iFanboys.
Yes.
I do a show called Science Sword. If you can check that out, sciencesword.com. I was a guest. I was asked to be a guest on somebody else's program. And I didn't run it by Carol again. I'm going rogue.
Yeah, didn't you? You got to clear that with us.
Well, this wasn't about comic books.
This is our brand you're messing with
here.
It's
about dinosaurs. So.
What if you went on some sort of eugenics show?
We gotta it was actually a genetics show because it was about Jurassic Park.
Is dinosaur eugenics okay to talk about? Are eugenics not only not okay if it's people?
I mean, they're mixing these dinosaurs with frogs, so that's clearly, I don't know what approach that is philosophically. Joseph Dorowski invited me to come on his podcast, The Protagonist Podcast, to talk. They talk about a great character and a great story every week. And I came on to discuss the first Jurassic Park film, and I decided to have my cake and eat it too. So we're talking Alan Grant, we're talking Ellie Statler, and we're talking Dr. Ian Malcolm. So I went with all three of the main professorial characters of that movie. And I rewatched Jurassic Park, guys, and it's so good.
It is good.
So check that out.
Yes, let's serve it.
Yes.
100%. On the Dueling Genre Network of podcasts. Thanks for having me on, Joe.
Get over to ifanboy.com. You can find all of our shows and vast history of comic book writing from all of the writers that were there. They were talented. I was like, I talked myself into a corner, so we're just going to get out. To find out what the pick of the week is before the show comes out, you can follow at ifanboy on Twitter, at ifanboycomics on Instagram. You can follow individually us folks, C.S. Kilpatrick and J.A. Flanagan on Instagram. And then Ryan Haupt on Instagram, or just Haupt, H-A-U-P-T, on Twitter. Of course, we have a YouTube page, youtube.com/ifanboy, where you can go and look at the old video shows that we did there. And, of course, the podcasts that we do, all the podcasts that we do go up there as well. Well,
including the Miracle Man show, it's on there.
Yeah, there you go. That's an excellent plug. Way to work in that marketing. That's why I don't work in marketing.
Is it my turn? Yes. If you like the show, if you've enjoyed this comic, 1 hour of comic book nonsense, please consider leaving a review or star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. It does really help. It helps people find the show. It helps the algorithm. It's just the best thing way you can help our show, Science Sword, of any show you listen to. And we really do appreciate that. Even better, that's word of mouth. If people ask you what shows you're listening to and enjoying, consider talking to my fanboy. No matter what their tastes or whether they're into comic books, they'll be very confused, but they will appreciate it. And we will as well.
I would tell my letter carrier about the show, but whenever my letter carrier comes, my dog loses her mind. So there's not a lot of conversation to be had between me and the old letter carrier.
What does the dog know that we don't? You should ask the letter carrier their views on
eugenics. They literally just started barking right now. I'm sure people can hear that in the background. Maybe the letters are here.
So there you go. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you for listening. Thanks for Ryan for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Until next week, I'm Connor.
I am Ryan.
I'm Josh. I got some homemade chili verde salsa I got down there I'm thinking about.
Ooh, that sounds tasty. We watch out for bears, people. They can come out of nowhere.
with a hairy bear. I call a knife, but you're a bear.
We gotta go. No time.
Yes, sir.
Three,
yes, sir.
Two. Hello, welcome to iFanboy Pick of the Week. Number. Fuck me. Three, two.
Sorry. Got me.
Three. You haven't talked to any adults in a while, have you? You're just I'm like, good. Anything?
I'm good.
Three, two.